This is Tammy Simon of Sounds True. We are delighted to partner with Raphael Kushner on the series Teaching What We Need to Learn. We at Sounds True recognize the value of leading with vulnerability and heartful authenticity on the spiritual journey, and we hope you find this series a significant contribution to that goal.
Welcome to another episode of Teaching What We Need to Learn. I'm your host, Raphael Kushner. In this series, I invite renowned teachers from many different perspectives and traditions to take a deep personal dive, to share with listeners in a way that brings us all closer together. I invite you to listen from your heart, opening fully to whatever speaks to you in the here and now. I also invite you to notice when you become curious to learn more, as well as when you're triggered, challenged, or called to share with the listening community. From the page at which you've accessed this recording, you can also click over to the Discuss section. That's where you can engage with one another about the themes of this series in a safe, honoring, mutually supportive way. Where it feels helpful, I'll join the discussion too. My guest in this installment of the series is Buddhist teacher and scholar Reggie Ray. Reggie addresses issues of transparency in a fresh way, drawing on his own experience with the controversial Rinpoche Chogyam Trungpa. He also has a profound reverence for the wisdom of the body, even amid illness, and lots to say about how to bring that into spiritual practice. There's much more at his website, dharmaocean.org. I hope that you, like me, appreciate Reggie's grounded, direct, loving presence.
Reggie, it's great to have you with us. Thank you.
Well, I'm looking forward to it.
All right, so just before we began the interview, you said to me that you thought that the theme of this interview series was important and timely. And I'd love to begin by just hearing a little bit more about what you meant by that.
Well, from the viewpoint of the tantric tradition, which is my training and my teaching, you can't really separate out spiritual teaching from the life of the teacher. And in some sense, you know, as a teacher, what you're doing is you're teaching directly out of the immediacy of the situation that you're having, you know, in your own life and with your students. And I think too often in our culture, spirituality is separated out as if it's some kind of commodity, some kind of external item that teachers have in their possession and they download onto other people. And at least from the viewpoint of our tradition, that's looking at it wrong way around.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when you said that you thought it was timely, is that because you feel like the other idea of the spiritual download has a certain kind of preeminence these days, or was there something else in addition you were thinking about?
Well, I think the idea of spirituality as a commodity that can be sold to other people is not only preeminent in our culture, but it's also very tenacious. And, you know, look at the number of books and the huge sales of spiritual books, really, which, you know, books are, you could say, second-level transmission. They're a transmission of ideas. That's hugely popular, but the number of people who really understand that spirituality is much closer to home is far and few between. So, and I don't think that, you know, ideas don't change people. Practice does, and sharing a space with an authentic teacher does. And I think that we need more of that, and we need less of the millions of publications that come out all the time.
Uh-huh. I'm struck, and I'm pausing, and I'm resonating with that that piece you just shared, that ideas don't change people, practice changes people. That's something that we haven't heard specifically in our series so far, so I think that's a really important point. Thank you for making it. I want to continue a little bit in regard to the tradition from which you teach, because you spoke about that. And,
yeah.
And your teacher, if I'm correct, was Trungpa. Is that right?
That's true, yeah.
And the experience of Trungpa in the United States and everything that happened when he came here is, you know, well documented from a lot of angles, and there's a lot of controversy involved in it. And I was wondering what you were taught and what you learned about transparency from the way that Trungpa both taught and lived his life in the presence of his students.
Well, this is a very interesting question. On April 4, just a few days ago, we had the 25th anniversary of his passing, and so I've been thinking a lot about that. And I'm going to say something, and I don't know how much sense it will make, but the most important thing he had to teach, which strangely enough you won't find in any of the books, strangely enough, or any of the articles, but the most important thing he had to teach was that, and he didn't teach it by talking about it as much as he did by how he was, is that it's part of the human thing that we always want to have a coherent and consistent and a well-defended point of view, a set of beliefs about reality. And we all do it, whether we're, you know, philosophers do it on one level, spiritual teachers do it, and people who are the most ordinary people in the world do it. We all have to have this sort of ego image, this image of the world, this idea about how everything is. And the thing about him was his life, to me, more than anything, was about disrupting those ideas and forcing all of us to confront reality not through the filter of our concepts about it, but nakedly and directly. And it's interesting, I was just talking with my wife about this last few days, because I ran into one of his old students, you know, from my own generation, and this really came up. Trungpa Rinpoche could not stand the sort of rigid concepts and rigid beliefs and rigid preconceptions that we all have about reality. And morning, noon, and night, he was doing things to disrupt what we thought. And it was very hard being around him for that very reason. It was very anxiety-producing. But that's what he did. That's what he taught. You don't have to have a fixed idea of reality in order to live. In fact, the fixed ideas are what get between us and life as it can be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes we use terms in the West that frame things differently from teachings from the East. And so I'm wondering if, in your experience with Trungpa, that if he spoke about anything that would be commensurate with the shadow, and how he would think about the shadow and the possibility of illuminating and integrating the shadow, even if one is not after a coherent worldview.
Well, you know, he didn't use that language, but if there was anything you were afraid of, somehow he found a way to put it right in front of you. And it was usually something about yourself. I mean, that's what the shadow is. It's those aspects of ourselves that we don't want to face and deal with. And he had this genius where he somehow arranged things so that suddenly you were face to face with things about yourself that you loathed or you found incredibly threatening. And he just did this all the time. It was very difficult to be around the man.
And then as a teacher, did he also show that transparently about himself? In other words, was he open and revealing about his own shadow aspects, even if he didn't call them that?
Well, you know, there are a couple of interesting points here. One is he never tried to hide anything, so that's interesting. And, you know, he had sexual relationships with his students, with some of his female students, and he never made the least effort to cover it up or hide it. So that's interesting, because he knew very well, you know, how the culture would respond. Also, he drank heavily, and we can talk about, you know, what the hell was going on there, which is an interesting conversation. But he never made any effort whatsoever to hide that. And also, he was just, there was a kind of openness to his whole process that was different from the way it is for most of us. So that, you know, that's one point. And I think the other point is he showed things about himself that most people would find very threatening. You know, for example, he got very, very depressed. And, you know, here we have this supposedly famous, you know, spiritual teacher who has all this, you know, there's all this press around him and his books and everything. And you'd think that with his students, you know, with anybody, frankly, he would be wanting to sort of keep some of the, because he knew depression in our culture, at least at that time, was very, looked really frowned upon. And it was like really bad for you to be depressed. And you'd think he would have made some effort to cover that up, and he didn't. He made no effort whatsoever. Mm. And the same with when he was sad or when he was, however he was feeling. So that was an interesting point. There was a story told which maybe illustrates this. One day in his house, there was some very important dignitaries. I don't know who they were. I think it might have been the Japanese ambassador or something to the United States. I don't know who it was, but somebody was in his house waiting for him downstairs with a couple of their people. And Rinpoche had gotten out of the shower, and he wanted to get something. And he just wandered through the living room, not where they were, but in the next room. But the door was open, stark naked. And his attendant, who was with him, just said the amazing thing was it didn't bother him. It didn't even seem to think about it, you know, being so open. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. But I want to take another step here. Is that okay with you?
I'm happy to, but I want to know, is it okay if we just, before we take the next step, just talk a little bit more about some of the pieces you just raised, because I think they're important.
Sure, yeah.
So,
let's do it.
Yeah, so the first thing is that you spoke about not hiding anything, and that's really important to me. In another conversation in this series, I was speaking to Mark Matusek, the spiritual memoirist and seeker, and he shared that in his experience, the most authentic teachers were the ones who were really out front, and that a true sign of a teacher to be wary of is one where there is any attempt to hide or to invest in a particular image of any kind.
Yeah.
And so I really hear the importance in what you're sharing about Trungpa, and just as a way for us to relate to other teachers in our own lives as well, which is that it's not necessarily about the foibles or the difficult aspects of a teacher's personality if, in fact, they're not choosing to hide, and if
yes.
they're there front and center, because then, even as a student, you have the opportunity to assess things from your own point of view, and you've got the whole story. So, for instance, you might have a legitimate conversation within yourself and with others about, do you want to have a spiritual teacher who's an alcoholic? And you could say yes or you could say no, but then it's up to you. You know, you're not
being
manipulated.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the same thing, you know, your spiritual teacher sleeps with practitioners. Is that okay with you? If so, why? If not, why not? And suddenly there's a real investigation, and it's not about pretend or image on any side. So that feels like it's an important piece to focus on. And then the other thing, just real quickly before you move on to your next piece, is you talked about depression and, you know, the way that Trungpa was open about his depression, even though he knew that it was seen as a problem in Western society when he was here. So I'm wondering, though, if you could speak to maybe what you saw and mean and what he saw and meant by depression, because often, you know, well, for instance, just speaking personally, depression to me is often a pushing down, just as the term implies. It comes from our resistance to emotional states that we don't want to experience. But from my understanding of him and his teaching, he would want to experience, he would welcome whatever emotions he was experiencing. So what specifically, how would you describe depression in his case?
Well, depression, one of the things that he said very early, and this was interesting because this this is really, in a way, what sealed the deal for me when I very first met him. And because I had been through about 8 or 9 years of very, very, very dark depression, and it was a question for me. And so when I met him, one of the things he said was, well, first of all, I knew that he had been through something very, very, very deep and dark in England before he came to the United States in the late 60s. But what he said was that depression is the most dignified and realistic of all the samsaric states. Depression is still samsaric means that depression still is happening with an ego framework, within an ego framework. But it's the closest, as he put it himself, depression is the closest thing to actual enlightenment that we can experience without, you know, actually crossing over. And what he meant by that was that in depression, you know, real depression and deep depression, you see that the usual way in which you spend your time and the usual kind of pursuits that everybody engages in are, you know, fundamentally meaningless. And meaningless in the sense that they don't deliver what we're hoping they will deliver. You know, that's not what they're about. And you're left feeling that there's no point even being alive. And the, you know, what makes it a samsaric state, you know, enlightened people within the Buddhist framework see the same thing, but they don't have the same response. And what makes depression depression is that there's still some feeling that it should be otherwise, and there's a kind of self-aggression in it that's very subtle. So that was interesting. And, you know, during his life, there were times when I saw him, even in very big social situations, and he was very, things were very dark for him at that moment, because what I surmise is that, you know, some of the things he was hoping for, he was seeing that there was nothing in it. They were empty, empty hopes.
So I'm really glad that I asked you to share more about that. I think it's an important teaching and really different from what most people hear. And I love, and I just want to draw out and highlight that idea that there's a truth to the way that when in depression we see the charade and the meaninglessness of most human pursuits.
Yeah.
And then there's also what we do with that.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that it sounds like what you're saying, and then maybe why he spoke so much to you out of your own personal experiences, because he was really honoring and validating what you were seeing, and then also offering the possibility that that could be true and didn't have to be argued against, and yet you didn't have to feel the way that you were feeling.
Well, yeah. I mean, in other words, another thing he said about depression is depression is an incredibly beautiful walkway. It's a passage. And so he offered he was basically saying depression is a journey, mm-hmm. and it needs to be respected, and it needs to be honored, and it needs to be, we need to be fully with it, as fully with it as we can. And that was so different from what I'd heard from other people.
Right, and he also, in his willingness to share his depression, was also not pretending to have reached some kind of permanent state in which he could
very
see
much.
The emptiness of the world and just be peaceful and joyful about it.
Oh, it's so true. Yeah.
Yeah.
But he, you know, studying with him, you know, for all those years, what I came to see is that the attachment to reality being joyful and peaceful and open is an ego state. That's not liberation. I mean, for him, true liberation is the freedom to experience our lives exactly as our lives turn up. And that's the tantric view. And again, not something that I was hearing from other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And so I want to make sure that we talk a lot about you and your own journey and your own experience, but I also want to make sure we come back to that thread. You'd said that there was someplace else you wanted to take us.
I mean, we are talking about my journey right now.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I didn't mean that it was segmented. I just meant that, you know, we're Trungpa is your teacher and is obviously, you know, instrumental in your journey. But there's also what happened in you and with you and through you when you weren't with him anymore. And we'll get to all of that. That's what I was just referring to.
Well, the only other thing I wanted to mention is that, you know, being around somebody like him, I met him in 1970. He died in 1987, so 17 years of just really being around him a lot. You know, in the beginning, you see this quality of total openness and transparency and also lack of apology, which is another something we might want to talk about. He was not apologetic about the life that he had and the person he was ever, and that was incredibly instructive. But also then, you know, when I started teaching, you know, with that kind of person as my teacher, there's a lot of pressure because, you know, you want to market yourself, you want to present yourself in a way that is going to appeal to people and their preconceptions. That's just part of human nature. But having a teacher like that, what are you going to do? Because, you know, the minute you start trying to do that, you remember him. So he's really... the way he was has had a huge impact, I think, on the people that studied with him and are now teaching. Mm. That we have to be transparent, we have to be open, and sometimes it really gets you in hot water, mm-hmm. you know, showing people your process and not trying to hide from them the person that you actually are day to day, you know, 24/7.
Can you say a little bit about what that hot water might look like or has looked like for you?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'll give you one example. I could give you, you know, hundreds. But some time ago, about 6 years ago, you know, I'd been in a marriage for 28 years. And in some ways, you know, it was the marriage in which I had children and, you know, raised children. And very, very close to my wife. But there were some very fundamental problems that... in the relationship that just wouldn't go away. And about 6 years ago, you know, after I'd been teaching for a long time and I had, you know, lots and lots of students and, you know, a large community, and I left her. And, you know, you try, and then you see everybody's being hurt by your sort of cowardice, because I think I hung out way too long with it for everybody's benefit. And my students basically said, that's not okay. You know, and as one of them said to me, it's not okay to have a teacher who's going to leave his wife, and I quit. And at that time, I lost a lot of students simply because I had a human life. And my response was, you know, my teaching is not about some idealized state. My teaching, following in the lineage of Chogyam Trungpa, is that life as it already is and the people that we already are is sacred, and we're not trying to override what life is based on some, you know, concept of saintliness. And I am not and never will be a teacher who tries to present something that's not human, because that's not spiritual. If it's not human, it's not spiritual.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I really appreciate you sharing that piece. I think it's really important, and it brings to mind a conversation that I had in this series with Harwell Hendricks and Helen LaKelly Hunt, the creators and stewards of Imago Relationship Therapy. And you know, they have some basic tenets. One tenet is that we unconsciously pick partners who have the potential to help us heal because they represent the unhealed aspects of our relationships with our primary caregivers early in life. And then also on the other side, that when we meet those partners, that they will we will also be unable to meet their needs for the same reason, and that in a healing partnership we can stretch in growing to meet their needs, and that's a gift, and vice versa. So I asked them a question from their perspective. Does that mean then that if you embrace that point of view of relationship as spiritual teacher, that you would never leave a relationship Could you ever see an experience where it felt like absolutely the right thing to do and in the highest good of everybody to say, well, this work here is done, or, you know, one or the other partner just is meant to move on? And it was interesting because they said that fundamentally their answer is no, that anybody who really was embracing the healing work of relationship would see that the path was there and they would choose and embrace that path. And I really understood what they were saying, I think, in part, or I resonated with it in part, but also I recalled, you know, or thought about as soon as they mentioned it, the fact that that kind of relationship that they're describing is one of real mutuality in which both people are consistently choosing to be as best as possible that kind of healing partner for one another. And if that's not working, or, you know, if one of the two people or both just isn't seeing the relationship as that kind of container, then staying together could be really hurtful. And that's what you just you alluded to. You said, you know, you'd hung on too long, and that desire to try to do it in what, you know, right, or, you know, as you thought it should be done, could end up also being something that one would hold on to.
Yeah, I think you put your finger exactly on it. Different people, you know, I think come into life with different missions. And in the tantric tradition, the consort relationship or the spiritual relationship between two people is exactly what you said, that there's an underlying commitment and a willingness to show up for the other person, to, number one, not hide out, which, as we know in relationships, happens. A lot of times we get into hiding out. So you show up, you have to show up for the other person, and you have to be willing to acknowledge what they see about you, and you have to be willing to change. And I'm not saying everybody is called to that kind of relationship, but some people are. And if you're called to that mutually transformative spiritual relationship with another person, both people have to be into it. That's what you basically what you just said, and it's true. And if one person, let's say one person is very severely traumatized, and maybe you know, alcohol is the only way in which they can live, get through the day, and they simply cannot be in that kind of relationship, it's, in my understanding at this point, it's your obligation to not to just hang out with it in a kind of you know, numb, ignorant, and maybe highly codependent way. You have to move on, and for the sake of yourself and for the sake of the people around you, and really for the sake of the other person also. So, you know, I think ideally speaking, yeah, everybody's spiritual, everybody ultimately wants to grow, but I think in practical terms, you know, that point of view can really justify an awful lot of poor behavior on our parts, you know, as partners in that kind of situation.
Right, and it's an ideal.
It's an ideal, yeah. And again, the tantric thing is you have to trust reality in the way reality shows up and not get hung up on your noble conceptions of what it could be.
Yeah, I love that. And it brings to mind something that Isaac Shapiro said in an interview for the series. He said, there's only one human drama, and that's not wanting the experience you're having.
Well, there's another kind of drama, but it's a drama like exploding stars and thunderstorms, and that's the real human drama, and it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. Thank you. So part of your journey, and I don't know where along the line it started, but your journey as a teacher in terms of what you present and what you live has to do with a deepening recognition of the body and the role of embodiment in awakening. And I'm wondering if you could just share a little bit with us about how that came to be, and how you ended up writing a book, in fact, called Touching Enlightenment, which really drives this point home. So how did that evolve for you?
Well, you know, I can experientially, it evolved just through my practice. And in the Tibetan tradition, there's a lot of emphasis on the body and meditation techniques that involve developing a deeper and deeper experience of the body and awareness of the body, and you could say knowledge of what the body really is. And I've done over my life a lot of retreat practice. That was something that Chogyam Trungpa really urged me to do. And so at this point, it's, you know, 5 or 6 years in solitary retreat accumulated time, and about the same in group retreats. And what happens when you do that much practice is your concepts about practice get broken down, and your ideas and your ambitions and your even your inspiration about what meditation is going to do for you, they just get worn down, they get broken down. And what you're left with, strangely enough, is a pretty empty, open awareness and the experience of life that happens when you're not thinking about things and you're not projecting a future. It's very physical, it's very embodied. You're left with literally with the experience of your body and with the world. And that, really changes things. And so that's, you know, that happened gradually. At the same time, you know, the tantric view is, it's all about what they call the redemption of matter, the redemption of the body, which means that through the practices, which again, I didn't think about this, I kind of went through it and then looked back, but through the practices, you begin to realize that all of the wisdom and all of the information that you need to live is found in your body and in your heart. It's immediate direct perception, and the activity of the left brain, which is the thinking brain and the strategizing and planning brain, the ego center, you know, as we know from neurobiology, it's actually not helpful. And the body needs to lead. So that's really kind of been my journey, and it's evolved over the past 40 years. It's been a very long process, but I'm at the point now where I really see the not only the necessity but the possibility for Western people to live from their bodies and to let the thinking mind be a handmaiden of the body rather than vice versa. And, you know, I look back at the tradition and realize the tradition says that the body is the Buddha mind. Mm-hmm. It's that simple. It's the awakened state is the awareness of the body. It's already in us and with us. And as long as we are willing to take our lead from the knowledge and the experience of the body, then our journey is very unimpeded.
Okay, so we've got some really rich things to talk about here. One question I have is, it seems like what you're saying is that in terms of left brain, right brain, body, mind split, that your perspective and the perspective of the tradition is that one needs to be the handmaiden, as you said, of the other, as opposed to a marriage of equality and equal usefulness if appropriately applied, so to speak. So I'm wondering, did I hear that right? Do you really feel like the one needs to lead the other?
Yeah, I would, when I talk about the body, I use the term soma, mm-hmm. you know, which is a Greek word for body, and that includes our physical body, you know, from the neck down. It includes the right brain, which, you know, is one center of intelligence for the soma. It includes the heart, which is another very important center of intelligence, and it includes the gut. All of those three areas, the right brain, the heart, and the gut, all have a huge number of neurons and process information in different ways. And when you take the totality of the soma, it is the primary organ of knowledge of all people. And the interesting point is when you tap into your soma, you have what Buddhism calls direct perception. It's not mediated by concepts. And there are all kinds of interesting things about it. It's open. It's not ego-based. It's what Jung called objective intelligence. And in Buddhism, it's called the Buddha mind, the mind of the Buddha. The left brain, interestingly, the thinking mind, it doesn't experience things directly. And even neurologically, the connecting link in our brain between the soma and the left brain is very tenuous. And what's happened in our culture is that, you know, when you, if you don't use it, you lose it in neurobiology terms. And we have actually, by not connecting the left brain with the soma, with the primary experience of life, we've actually lost the ability even to feel what the body knows anymore. So I would say, you know, just to reiterate what you just said, that our life, in Buddhist terms, in the terms of neurobiology, in terms of many religions, our life needs to be led by the part of our intelligence and our wisdom that is not ego-driven. And then the job of the left brain, the thinking mind, the ego center, is to be a handmaiden and very much in secondary position to mediate what the soma knows. Now, one thing from neurobiology which is very, very interesting is most of the things that we generate in our left brain and we think that we're coming up with through our thinking are actually initiated by the body. And even though people don't know it in our culture, many, many conclusions we come to because the body has already come to that conclusion. And then in our left brain, we come up with a logic that justifies it. So isn't that interesting?
It is. As a matter of fact, there's a brilliant short book about that subject called The Mind's Past, you might know, by Michael Kazanaga, who describes in scientific detail the way that the personality housed in the left brain, in order to continue to believe the fiction that it's in control, actually pretends that it has made decisions when it can be clearly demonstrated that the decision has been made prior to any kind of conscious deliberation.
Well, that's fabulous. I haven't seen the book, but I'm about to order it.
Yeah.
That's great.
So just a couple other things to follow up on this. So I think it's a really important theme for all of us. We're talking about the intelligences that live in the body or the soma, as opposed to the ego or personality structure that lives in the left brain. So with that as a kind of a map, what part of us pays attention? So let me just add a little bit to that before you answer it. You were talking about direct perception, and one of the things that I share with people is that when you're going to be surfing your emotions, when you're going to be entering into the realm of the body as an explorer in a new way, the left brain needs something to do. Because it's a problem-solving machine, it looks at everything as a problem, and if you don't give it something to do, it's going to just kind of get in there and make it all something to solve again. And so it's really important to recognize that, you know, when you surf, there's the surfer on the wave, and then there's the wave itself. And so in tuning into soma, the fact that the brain or the left brain's job is to pay attention is really significant. At least that's how I describe it. But I'm wondering, given your own wisdom about this and how you work with people, would you say that attention is a left brain function, or would you see it as something different?
I think it's very well said, the way you describe it. Initially, we need to bring our conscious orientation to attention, attend to the body, to the soma. But one interesting thing that happens, so I 100% agree with what you just said, but there's a second step that is quite important, which is once you, through practice, once you learn how to come quickly and fully into the experience of the objective mind or the Buddha mind of the body, what you realize is there's another kind of attention that is always there, and it's the attention of the body. And here I would say, rather than using, I think we could use the word attention, but we could also use the word awareness. There's what we might call a self-existing or uncreated awareness that the body always has. And so really, when you tap into that, then you don't need the attentive faculty anymore once you learn how to reside within the attentiveness that is already there in the body. So I see what you just described as most of meditation practice is paying attention to the body, paying attention. But then there comes a moment which might only be brief, it could be a fraction of a second, when all of a sudden you're not paying attention anymore, you're just there. And the quality of your awareness is heightened, and there is a sense of being fully present to your world. So there's nothing outside of that you need to pay attention to. So that's interesting. And I think the purpose of meditation is using the technique you just described, which is paying attention, in order so that we can be attention at a certain point.
Yeah, I love that. And it really demonstrates that paying attention is important, but it's essentially a bridge toward that effortless being attention that you're describing, or being awareness.
Exactly. Yeah, that's well said.
Yeah. So the other thing, though, I wanted to touch on is that, because I'm with you 100% on the wisdom of the body in all of the different ways that you just described, and yet I'm aware that there's, in holistic-oriented and sometimes in spiritual circles too, there's a certain kind of what I would call easy thinking or simplistic thinking about the body. You'll hear people say all the time that the body knows how to heal itself if we just get out of the way. And in many cases, that's true. But in a lot of cases, the body just develops child leukemia and dies. And it's not about healing if healing means physical well-being or even survival. We'd have to have a much broader sense of, what healing means, which, of course, you can heal into death, for example, if we're going to say that the body always knows how to heal. So I'm wondering how you, in your own teaching and in your own personal understanding, factor in that kind of, I don't know if this is the right word, but what's coming to me is that natural fallibility of the body.
Yeah, that you raise some really interesting points. The first thing is, when people say the body knows how to heal itself if we get out of the way, I think, there's a kind of new age imprecision, and I'd say sort of fluffiness, and naivete in thinking that, oh, we can just get out of the way. The dynamic between the ego mind and the body is a lifelong dynamic, and you cannot, nor should you ever aspire to get rid of your ego mind. So, in other words, we never get out of the way. We're always in the way. But being in the way and knowing we're in the way of ourselves and working with that, that's the transformative journey. And that's where the New Age thing is really not helpful, because it gives people the impression that somehow, there's some idealized state of the human person where there are no problems anymore. So I don't think that model is very helpful, saying if we get out of the way, the body knows how to heal itself. But I think it's more, we need to be more realistic and say, well, we get in our way at a global level, we get in our way at the most personal level. We create a lot of situations out of being human that are causing a lot of problems for ourselves, and those are what we have to work on. So I, as a practitioner, need to work on the fact of how much I don't listen to my body and how much my ego mind needs to grow and, over the course of my whole life, become a vehicle for the wisdom of the body and less a vehicle for its own self-aggrandizement. You see what I mean? So it's a little shift of emphasis. Again, it's coming back and respecting the fact that we have a soma that is, basically enlightened, and then we have an ego mind that needs to make a journey around that, and that's our actual situation, and respecting that dynamic and not disrespecting one side of it, such as the ego.
Yes, and I'm guessing you would say that soma that is enlightened could also be, quote-unquote, sick or ill.
Well, not from the soma's point of view. In other words, if somebody has leukemia, There are two ways to experience that. One way is from the viewpoint of the conventional mind, the ego mind, the left brain. It's a big problem, and we have to address it, and, you know, this is really terrible, and think of all the terrible things that we're going to experience, and think about, you know, all the fear we have of pain. But another way to experience it is from the viewpoint of the soma itself. And when we view pain or illness or tension or distress or conflict from the viewpoint of the soma, we see it as part of how the universe works. And even if we ourselves are dying, we understand when we see it from the objective and the non-ego viewpoint of the body, we just simply hold that as part of the dynamic of being itself. You know, stars are born and stars die, and amoebas are born and amoebas die. It's part of the round of life. So I wouldn't even say that we need to, even when the body is what we would call ill or diseased, we don't need to see that as a problem.
Right. So just making this very specific and personal for a moment, because I think that's helpful for listeners, for almost 30 years now, I've had what is usually referred to as chronic fatigue syndrome,
yes.
which also means something like we don't know what's wrong with you. That's a longer discussion, and I'm very open with this. I think I've talked about it elsewhere in the series.
Yeah.
But the reason that I'm bringing it up here is that every day of my own personal life is engaged with the symptoms that are a part of that energetic challenge in living. And so over the years of working with it as best as I could, I got to a place where I recognized that I do have a preference, a human preference, that if it were possible for me to have better and more consistent energy for living, I would love that. And I will do what I can whenever possible to see if that is something that I can move forward with. And at the same time, it's come to me to understand that it's also equally important to be with it as it is and to recognize that if that preference doesn't come to pass, that doesn't mean that there's something wrong, that there's something wrong with me, or that somehow my ability to live in fullness is compromised, that in fact this is just the fullness that I'm meant to be living because this is what is.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're married to a very difficult partner.
Yes, sir, I am.
And your partner really has your number, meaning that you can't do what you want to. I mean, are you married?
Well, you first were speaking about my partner in my illness, but now you're asking me about, am I literally married to another person?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I mean, so am I. And my experience is it's just really difficult. I mean, I love this person with my whole heart, and this person has brought me life. And one way that my wife brings me life is she doesn't go along with me. And, you know, very, very tender, very present, or let's say she doesn't go along with my neurosis. She doesn't go along with my ambition. When I disconnect from her or from our son, she doesn't go along with it. She's not mean. She just doesn't go along. And I've been through, you know, illness myself, and it's the same exact thing. It's sort of like, for me, you know, being ill for a long time, I had to constantly relate to this partner who was basically in bed with me all the time, and I couldn't do this, and I couldn't do that, and I wanted to do this, and I couldn't. I wanted to do this in this way, and I couldn't. It was like constantly being brought up short, and that's the way it was with Trungpa Rinpoche, and that's the way it is with my wife, and that's the way it has been when I'm ill. And somehow, I understand that this illness, my thing was I had a very, very serious, almost lethal candida infestation that, and for 7 years I was, you know, almost immobilized. And for 1 year I was actually in bed. And I realized that this was the gift of the universe to me because my personality is too, I don't know, it's too ambitious, it's too narcissistic, it's too strong, it overrides other people, at least, you know, it would like to. And so it was like having the brake on all the time on my ego. And so, you know, I don't know, it just sounds like, I don't want to speak for you, but it sounds like you just have you're married to that kind of partner. You're married, your body is not going to let you off the hook. And of course, with the people, with my experience, the people I work with, it's the people who have been through illness that actually understand the most, to be truthful. Mm. There was one point when I was told I was going to die of cancer, and I hung around a lot of people with cancer and people who were dying and, you know, people who were getting better. But the basic thing was this group of people understood things about life that the general population simply doesn't. And that really helped me realize that those whose bodies will not let them simply override are the lucky ones. And, you know, people like you and me are lucky, even though it's painful and many times we just hate it. It's a blessing. It truly is, because it does change us. It makes us be more than we would have been otherwise.
Yeah, yeah. And just to, you know, make things on the one hand more complicated, but also hopefully to enrich this discussion, in the midst of having that 30-year experience, I also had something which there's no real name for it, but we can call it an energetic opening. Some people refer to it as kundalini. But the reason I wanted to bring it up is because a different kind of energetic channel opened up in me and began to share the space of my soma.
Interesting.
And when that first happened, I was so hopeful because I thought, well, this is so powerful, it's going to completely burn out chronic fatigue syndrome.
Yeah.
And then, in fact, what happened is that it just all took up residence together, and nothing cancels out the other. But
they each
are different teachers, because sometimes, or most of the time, the fatigue and its related symptoms does exactly what you described. It's a softener. It says you can't do what you want to do. You can't run over people with your will and all of that.
Yeah.
And then the other energy, which is so expansive and glorious and outrageous, it offers great heights, but it also doesn't care about the body and will actually kill the body if I don't step in and say, okay, well, that's a little bit too much. You know, it will override the limitations of physiology. And so as much as I was enticed by all of those great energetic heights, I had to also recognize, okay, there are certain places where I have to come in and say, well, this is my body too, and I have to be caring for it, because I can do that in a way that this energy can't or won't or doesn't understand. And ultimately, the process of living day to day with both of those things happening, along with what we might call kind of more ordinary everyday consciousness, has made me really sensitive to the experiential reality of multiplicity, not the idea of it like, oh, we all have different parts of ourselves, but the sense that what is moving through every day in the awareness that I would call me is just so much more than I ever could imagine to be in control of or understand. And, you know, we all have those unconscious processes going on anyway, like digestion and all of that. But in these cases, with these, you know, extra additions to the situation, I'm just most of the time kind of holding on for dear life.
Well, you know, that's the definition of Tantra. You know, the term means that there's no continuity, there's no thread you can hang on to, that in each moment your life is a particular way, but there's not necessarily going to be any discernible continuity with what happened 5 minutes ago. And I think you're really describing that. And what, you know, for a person whose life is like that, I mean, I think the chronic fatigue totally opened you up. And then life becomes this, like you said, it's so much bigger. And the only way you can deal with it is actually to relate to each moment. You can't really be importing you were tired yesterday or you were energized yesterday. It doesn't help. So, you know, the ego continuity that we're always trying to come up with, at a certain point, it just breaks down. And all you can do is relate directly, intelligently, openly, and without ambition to whatever is going on. And that's what I'm hearing you describing, that process.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly imperfect at it, but it is my intention. And one of the things that that also happens along the way, this connects back to our talk earlier about attention being a bridge towards an awareness that isn't effortful. When somebody has a chronic illness, they end up being way more vigilant about where they are at any moment, or vigilantly aware. People who have an abundance of energy and physical well-being are kind of profligate with their energy. They're not thinking about what's going to happen the next hour, or, oh, this is one of those places where I'm going to pay for it if I'm not a little bit extra cautious. So that vigilance is not ultimately helpful, because there's a holding on to it, which is sort of the opposite of the tantra that you're describing. But it also has a consistency of attention that I think has the potential then to shift into a more spacious awareness. And I think that that's something that I've, you know, been in an education about for a long time.
You know, that's a really, really, really good point. You develop a level of mindfulness through being sick that ordinary people don't have, and it becomes incredibly refined. And that gift, I mean, in the beginning, it does, like you're suggesting, it does seem obsessive, it seems compulsive, it seems too paranoid, too vigilant. But actually, you're developing a tool that, again, as you just said, it's going to help you deal with life at every possible level, because before you can be aware, you have to be present. And what you're learning, what we're all learning through this process you describe, is to be in a very refined and precise way, be present every single moment and every single subtlety. And those then become stepping stones into this open, non-judgmental awareness that we're looking for, where we find the real freedom and the sort of open-ended joy of life. So you described this beautifully, and I think you completely are on how the process works.
Well, thank you for that reflection. I appreciate that. And in the few minutes that we have left, I would love to focus on you now, meaning, as you just said, that from the tantric perspective, it's not there's nothing more than being able to look without a narrative or some kind of consistent thread. So with that in mind, in these recent minutes and hours and days, what's drawing your attention about your own self, your own process? What feels like it's maybe up right now, or not resolved? Where are you in the glorious mess of things?
Well, this is going to sound strange after 40 years of spiritual practice, but I feel at this point I've figured something out that I knew intellectually before, but now it's sort of becoming an experiential possibility, and I'll just tell you really simply what it is. It's not that different from what we're talking about. But I'm realizing that it's possible to, let's put it this way. In Buddhism, the mind is called citta, and actually mind is a terrible translation. The seat of our intelligence and our awareness is the human heart. And we often translate that as mind, but it's completely misleading. What we're looking to develop is not the awareness of the head, but the awareness of the heart, at least, when you look at it from within Buddhism. And what I'm starting to see, and this is through practices that I've been doing for the last couple of years, is that you can experience the world from within the intelligence of the heart without needing to go through any filter. And when you do that, the interesting thing about, of course, the heart is part of the body, And so we have this objective intelligence. But the heart is able, the heart really is the organ in our body where we perceive the interconnection of all things, and where we have the sense of passion and longing and love for the world. It's really where that, the whole body has it, but it really comes to heightened awareness in the heart. And I'm beginning to realize that through some of the practices, again, that we do in our tradition, that we can begin to experience and see and feel and know the world from the heart. And often, you know, we're afraid of that knowledge. In fact, most of our hearts are really shut down, and when we attend to our heart, we just feel numb or we feel pain. But through the meditation practice that works with the heart, we can open that organ of perception or that seat of awareness, and we begin to see the world from that point of view. And we do see tremendous suffering. We see exactly how it is with other people. And we even gain the ability to be able to feel how it is to be that person. We know that person. We can actually be that person. So that's really what's going on for me now, is like, okay, that's it. This is it. And this is what I want to work on now for the next decade or two, if I live that long. Because that's the fundamental human capacity that we need in this world. We need to know how to feel what it's like to be a mountain or an ocean or another person or an animal, and then we need to be able to act on that and translate that love in the way we go about things. So I think for the human race it's needed, and I think for me personally, that's what I'm working on.
I'm hearing the possible echoes of some of the indigenous teachings that are also a part of what you share, in that ability of an open and connected heart to be able to know not just what another individual is experiencing and to be them really through that awareness, but also other creatures and even the earth itself. Did I hear that correctly?
You did, and I would also include in that to know what it's like to be the sun or the moon or stars or even galaxies or black holes. The interesting thing about the heart is the electromagnetic energy of the heart goes out forever. It becomes more attenuated, but it reaches to the end of our, some people think the universe is 15 billion light years in extent, and our heart actually touches, that 15 billion light years away. Now, it's interesting. Yes, and to be human is to know, the state of being, not just to see from the outside, but to feel and know from the inside the state of being of everything in this, incredibly vast, beautiful universe, mm-hmm. and to act on those connections. And, of course, that's what we've lost in our modern world.
Yeah, and we had Howard Martin of HeartMath in this series, who speaks also to this wisdom of the heart. And the HeartMath Institute has a global coherence initiative that is really based on that endless reaching out, let's say, or holding that the heart is capable of. I'm glad you brought us back to that.
Yeah, I'm aware of their work. The only thing I would say, and actually I need to be in conversation with these folks, I don't think they have the practices. I think they have the point of view and they have some of the practices, but they don't. I would like to be in touch with them and show them some things from the Tibetan tradition that open the heart up in a much more direct, immediate, and infinite way.
I'm glad you mentioned
that.
In the Jewish tradition, there's something called a shidduch, which is like an arranged marriage. Mm. And if I could be the matchmaker that somehow brought the two of you together, I'd be honored and delighted to do it, because I'm sure that we would all benefit. But
let's look to it. That'd be fun.
Yeah. And before we go, because we have to go in just a minute or two, I want to follow up on that question, because I really heard and appreciated what you were saying about where it's at for you right now, and as you look over the horizon towards these next years. But in terms of the kinds of challenges that people face just in everyday living, is there anything that, in the spirit of transparency, you would recognize as hard for you now, where you find yourself going into struggle or something similar?
Well, I think one thing is I feel I'm too distracted by my life in terms of the work that I want to do now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm married, I have a son, I have a community I have to look after. So, you know, there are a lot of external things that I can use as excuses. I mean, I do my daily practice, I do my yearly retreats, but I feel too distracted, frankly. And I'm trying to, and I know we all face that, my students tell me that, everybody tells me that, that this culture provides so many opportunities and so many delicious and provocative and tempting invitations to all kinds of things. And I need to simplify somehow. And I'm not planning to, you know, my marriage and my family is right at the heart of my spiritual life, so that's a given. And my work is a given. But within that framework of modern life, how can I live a more simple and more focused life, and also a life that is more in line with my deepest intentions and my deepest aspirations? How can I do that? So I'm working on that.
That's great. That's really helpful. I appreciate you sharing that. And I appreciate all you've shared today and the great warmth and clarity that you brought to our discussion about what it means to be not just radically transparent, but radically aware of life as it comes moment by moment, without the grand story, without the cohesive narrative, just one moment at a time as it is. That feels so powerful. And I really thank you for taking part in this series and for gifting us with your time today.
Well, a lot of it's you, and you're in the same place, so it was great to talk.
You've been listening to Teaching What We Need to Learn, a unique online interview series in which leaders of personal growth and spirituality share their own innermost challenges. Two interviews are released each week during the series at teachingwhatweneedtolearn.com. That's also where you can send friends, family, and colleagues to sign up for the series, and I sincerely hope you will. We're also on Facebook as Teaching What We Need to Learn. The series producer is Julia Zaslow. Our chief technical officer is Kenneth Bushman. Our designer is Shannon Medisky, and our email management guru is Diana Pearson. Theme music is by Stephen Walters. You can find him at stephenwaltersmusic.com. A special thank you to our many volunteers and supporters, especially Bonnie McFarlane and Sandy Child. I'm Raphael Kushner. You can learn more about my work and reach me personally at kushner.com. That's C-U-S-H-N-I-R. During the first week of June, I'll be teaching in Oslo, Norway. During the last week of June, I'll be holding a weekend and week-long workshop at the Kripalu Center for Yoga and Health in Massachusetts. You can find much more information about both of those events on my website. Thank you again for joining me, and please come back again soon.